we come marching at the dawn of the day. All the darkened kitchens, the mill of gray, all touched by the radiance that the sun discloses.
Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses. Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses.
Hello, you're on the Bread and Roses show. This is WJOX 103.3 Valley Free Radio. Bread and Roses is a weekly show on which we discuss issues of social justice and economic equality and have a variety of guests. My name is Una Doherty, and I sort of have a sub-show called Just a Bunch of Old Radicals. This is my first live show, so be prepared for scratching records and the occasional bit of dead air space, but I think we can handle it. My guest today is Michael Holroyd, who can share his memories of activism in the 1960s and 70s. And I think we're actually going to start with a little music, so hold your breath, it'll be there momentarily. Okay, Michael. Well, welcome to Just a Bunch of Old Radicals.
Well, thank you, Una, for inviting me. Thank you so much.
I think what I'd like to ask you about is what got you interested in politics? How old were you? What sort of formed your interest in issues of social justice and politics?
Una, just a very brief background. I was born in Ireland. I lived 1 year of my life there, even though my parents were English. Then I lived in England for 6 years. And when I was seven, eight, nine, ten, I lived in India, which was a real eye-opener for me as a very, very young boy. I came back to England, and my parents were always quite political. They were very much involved in the British Liberal Party that had its liberal moments, but was also a little conservative. But when I was 18, now we're in 1964, I happened to go for a year to West Africa and teach math, English, and West African history to 30 students who were all older than me at a college in rural Gambia, the Gambia. And that really opened my eyes. It began, it really, having lived in India for 3 years, but as young, before any political consciousness took over, when I was in West Africa, I suddenly realized, wow, there is a huge difference between the life of people here and the life that I was used to in England. So when I came back, now it's 1965, and so much was going on in the world, and my personal experience, so now suddenly, you know, the issue that really came to the fore was the one of black and white. It's amazing how it's come around a whole circle. Now we have signs in downtown Northampton saying Black Lives Matter. Well, I took that literally because I had been with in a society where I was one of the very few whites. There were like 300-400 whites in a population of 400,000. And there were only about 3 white people at this college that I was at, and Gambia had just become newly independent. So suddenly issues like apartheid in South Africa came right to the fore for me. So I came sort of radicalized when I was about 17, 18, 19.
I think you told me about an incident when you were watching television and you saw something that inspired
Well, when I
you.
Was about that age, I can't remember the exact year, but it was the middle 60s. There was a very famous South African poet called Dennis Brutus, a black South African poet. And he had been, like many South Africans, some had been jailed. And some were just given a one-way ticket out of the country. And he was in England, and he had thought of ways how to protest this system of apartheid, which is racial segregation. And for listeners who may not be sure what apartheid is, there was a country, South Africa, there were about 4 million whites, they had all the power, they had the vote, 26 million blacks could not vote, had to carry an individual passbook of about 48 pages justifying their presence in any location in the country. They could be arrested on whim. They were degraded in all kinds of manners. It wasn't a system of slavery that they had in the South in the United States, but it was pretty close to it. So,
and this is in the late 20th century.
Yeah. So here, this man, one day I happened to be watching television, and the South Africa felt that as long as they could send their all-white teams to the rest of the world, that they really didn't have to do much about apartheid. It showed that they were basically accepted. And sport had a really big significance for South African mm-hmm. society. They were a very sports-minded nation. The whites were, in any way.
So can I just get this straight? Yes. You're telling me that in a country where the majority of the people were black, the sports team were only made up of Afrikaners yes. and British people?
And British. That's uh-huh. all they were. And South Africa is very strong rugby. They love their uh-huh. cricket and such things like that. Anyway, they were playing a tennis match called the Davis Cup. So it was the all-white South Africans were playing at Wimbledon against a British team. And I don't even remember if it was single or doubles. But this South African poet who was protesting apartheid walked onto the court during the match with a whole bag of rock salt. And he threw it right over the court. And of course, there was a big, you know, the British, oh my God, boy gosh, this is terrible, you know. I say, this is most irregular. How terribly,
not
terribly
sporting,
awful. This
sporting.
Is not sporting. My God, you can never mix politics and sport. This is awful. And anyway, the match could hardly go on because now there was no way of telling whether the ball was in or out because the rock salt had smeared everywhere and basically the match came to a halt. But there was a whole generation of us, older teenagers, that thought, yes, this is something we can do in England to protest against a nation, Britain, that was one the main supporter of racial oppression and apartheid in South Africa because it had been a British colony.
And what a huge audience, too.
Yes.
All the sportsmen, everybody watching television.
Absolutely.
It
so
really brought the issue to the attention.
South Africans really helped us by deciding now they're going to send an all-white rugby team to England to play 40 matches every Wednesday and every Saturday, and it was an organizer's dream come true, because now they're playing in Leicester on Wednesday, they're going to play in Nottingham on Saturday. So a bunch of people, including myself, got together and we formed an organization called Stop the Tour. Well, it was Stop the 70s Tour, because in 1970 the South Africans proposed to send the all-white cricket team. So this would be a trial run. So we went around the country. And say in Leicester, we'd have a meeting like on the Tuesday evening. A lot of students would come from all the local colleges because, you know, this was an issue that had now come to the fore because people knew about Nelson Mandela. He was the world's most famous political prisoner. He'd been sentenced. He'd been caught in 1962. In 1965, the final appeal of their treason trial was like decided by the South African Supreme Court. They were given life imprisonment. He was there, actually turned out for 27 and a half years, but he became a big rallying point. So what could we do? So we would have a meeting. The students would all come. The next day, we'd all march to the ground. Some of us would buy tickets. Anyway, we'd have a big demonstration. Some would get in. And then when the game started, we'd run onto the field. And this happened again and again at Twickenham, I remember.
What did you do when you got onto the field?
Well, when we got on the match at Twickenham, 300 managed to get through. And we formed one of those circles wherever, you know, it gets larger and larger. Uh-huh. And we linked arms, and the police were absolutely livid. It took them 45 minutes. Basically, they cleared us out by pulling our hair and sort of dragging us.
And did you have quite long hair in those days, Michael?
I did. My hair was down to my shoulders,
oh,
and it
my
was
goodness.
Very painful. And, of course, you involuntarily let go when you linked arms. But we were in the spirit of civil disobedience, but nonviolent. We had no beef with the police. We would start talking to them and say, this is what we're doing. And most of them were not sympathetic. Some of the older ones were. I happened to be one of just two people who broke up a match between the British Army and the South Africans at Aldershot, which was the headquarters of the British Army. 15,000 people were in the stands shouting, hang him, flog him, kill him, shoot him, because they were certainly not supporters of anybody to break up one of their favorite sports. Mm-hmm. So I remember being dragged off the pitch with two policemen. The young one is telling me to, you know, swearing at me, and the older one telling both of us, calm down, lads. I was saying, you must understand, I'm not against you. I'm doing this for us. Do you know what happened in South Africa? You know, it's illegal for a black and white to have sex together, you know? And this was the kind of thing that, in fact, today I was telling some high school kids, I said, do you realize I had a friend who was white, who was living in South Africa. And, you know, some blacks were well off, very, very few, but one was a black professor at the university she was working at. And late one night, about 12:30 at night, there was a rapping at her door, and in came representatives of BOSS, which was the Bureau of State Security. They rushed in there with a warrant, and they took all her bedsheets away. And she says, what are you doing? So they said, well, we're going to test your bedsheets to see if there's any semen on it, because it's illegal. It's against the Immorality Act to have sex between a black and a white. So anyway, this is the kind of thing that was going on in South Africa. So that was my first activism, and it was very successful because many of the matches were stopped, and the South Africans then, after that, never sent an all-white team to Britain of any kind.
And I'm sure the issue was brought to the attention of
yes.
millions and millions of people.
And when I subsequently came to the United States and ended up in Northampton, the issue of apartheid was an ongoing one, and I got to know people at the American Friends Service Committee here in town.
I think we're going to take a break for a little bit of fundraising, and we will be right back.
Good.
Okay, Michael, so we opened the show with the Rolling Stones song Street Fighting Man, and I wanted to ask you about some of your experiences at demonstrations in Britain in the 1960s. I know that you yourself are committed to peaceful civil disobedience, but I'm kind of curious as to what it was like then. You know, what were the times like? How many demonstrations were there? What did you see? That kind of thing.
Well, I think the 1960s is unusual for this particular reason. It was a conjunction of all kinds of protests, campaigns that just happened to all come together at the same time. And I often tell people today, it's just around the corner. I sincerely believe this. The pendulum has come back the other way, is that people dig these little streams, and they all come together. Because as teenagers in England in the 60s, first the focus before apartheid came to the fore, although that was always running along, people looked to the United States, and what do they hear about? Martin Luther King. When you go, because in England there wasn't much TV at the time, you went to your local news station, you went to the cinema, and they'd always have one of those big Pathé news. And I remember always there would be people trying to get into school in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1957. There were sit-ins starting in 1960-61. There was all kinds of boycotts. There was the Selma March, 1965. This is what people in Europe were sort of galvanized by. So you have the whole civil rights movement. Then you have February 1965, Lyndon Johnson made this huge decision to really start sending 500,000 troops to Vietnam. First 200,000, then another 100,000. So you get the whole anti-imperialist struggle as well as the civil rights struggle coming together. And then in England, towards the end of the 60s, you have a sudden eruption of the civil rights campaign in Northern Ireland and the reawakening of the Irish Republican Army, which had been asleep for 20 years or so, and suddenly were caught unawares by people who were asking for basic civil rights in Northern Ireland. So you had all these issues all sort of came together. So, while there'd be an anti-apartheid demonstration one month, then there'd be a Vietnam mm-hmm. solidarity demonstration the next month. And then there'd be another demonstration, which slowly took off ground against Britain sending
and
troops.
And Michael, were you at university at this time?
I went to university from 1965 to 1968, and it was a galvanizing time, and especially 1968, because as all university students in England at the time all had to sit down, and after 3 years, because an undergraduate degree is done in 3 years, and there are no papers, there's no accumulating grades, it's all done by competitive exam. That's done at the end. And I'll never forget Monday, May the 13th, which happened to be my birthday, as I had been occupied by students and by young communists and young socialists. Because here's another issue. The whole question of, de Gaulle's Republic was under question. All these issues all together. So 1968, the Tet Offensive, the assassination of Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, the Russians coming into Czechoslovakia. It just seemed everything was like the ordered world was like in disarray. And the elites were sort of, I think for people who are making change, when elites begin to feud amongst themselves, this is an opportunity. When the elite is unified like it was in South Africa for a long time, it was very, very difficult to get any change. But once elites begin to have dissension in their own ranks, like again in South Africa when the business community finally saw the writing on the wall in the 1980s, and the anti-apartheid movement, especially in the United States, was now added to the anti-apartheid movement in Europe, when Reagan's veto was overridden in the United States Senate, then, my God, the writing was on the wall. The elites in South Africa were sort of not sure of how to proceed.
It sounds as though as undergraduates, you had tremendous, that many yes. of you had tremendous awareness of what was happening in different parts of yeah. the world and cared deeply about
yes.
it. And had you, were there any particular demonstrations or events that were memorable to you that you'd
I think I remember in 1968 the demonstrations, which we found out much later. I mean, this became an issue in the presidential campaign because I was at these demonstrations outside the American Embassy in London in 1968, at which apparently Mr. Bill Clinton was at, and the Republicans were
He was attending as a student who was studying in the
United
Kingdom.
He was at Oxford University at the time,
oh, yeah.
and I know that the Republicans were desperate to try and find anything. Was there any pictures of it? Anything showing him doing something really terrible? Like, it's hard sometimes for American audiences to understand, although some of my generation might, because the same thing happened during the anti-Vietnam demonstrations, is that there were always factions and sections who wanted to be more militant, even more violent mm-hmm. than the majority, because I think the majority were happy to march, to protest, to refuse with their own bodies, maybe even leave to go to Canada or to Europe or try and, refuse to fight. But very few were going to the stage of actually participating in violence. So I remember at these demonstrations, what was a bit scary was, you know, there were groups of people, some called themselves like the Spartacus League. I mean, they came with these huge bags of marbles and they rolled them out so the police horses would fall over, because the police often try to control demonstrations and police horses do not like marbles being rolled at them because they'll fall over. And then some came with a lot of matches, and they would open the, you know, on the side streets of the embassy, they would open the gas tanks to anything that said U.S. government property, vehicles, and put in tissue, light the tissue to, you know, ignite the vehicles. And there were several of that. So it was a very scary kind of time. It was hard.
And how did the police react with the crowd? I understand that you and most of your friends were sort of participating in peaceful disobedience.
I mean, it's hard
marching,
because what happened then? I mean,
like,
some police obviously lost it, you know, and behaved very wildly. And, you know, it sort of mirrors what happened in this country. Many police lost it, like at the demonstrations in 1968 in Chicago, which was eventually classified at the Democratic National Convention, which was classified as a police riot, you know. So it's hard, because what I think we came to understand, it took a while, we weren't there in the 60s, is that the police are basically, we're on the same side, because they tend to be young, they tend to be very working class, they face the same issues that you do, even if you are so-called student or privilege, you know. And I think many of us are learning now, to bring it back to present times, you know, what is this issue of white privilege? We're all part of it, even if we think we're liberal or radical, even if we're here in Northampton. It's good. It really warmed my heart to see over 500 people, and, you know, outside City Hall after the shooting in Ferguson, Missouri, to see a few middle school students, and to see a few high school students and college students, as well as some older people, to see black and white all talking about Black Lives Matter. We have to confront this issue of white privilege, that these issues still go on in one form or another. We're not there yet. We're not in a racially free society. We're not in an equal society.
It is indeed. It's a great thing that some consciousness has been. There's now more consciousness and more the issues being reexamined and addressed, and people are protesting. I think that's important.
I'm thinking that, you know, a record that always spoke to that generation, I don't know if you want to play it now or later.
Sure.
The times are changing.
Okay, we could put that on.
Because, am I directing traffic here?
No, that's absolutely fine, Michael. All right, this is one of the things we're going to do on this show is our guests get to choose a couple of tracks of music that remind them of the times that they're talking about. And
I think Bob Dylan, if I can interject, he was like a poet of that generation, and he was a great artist. He was an artist that wouldn't compromise. He went his own way. He upset a lot of supporters at various times. But I think when you look back at his whole career, I mean, he's been one of those remarkable people to be both ahead of his time on many occasions. And even if his songs weren't overly political at times, somehow they spoke to us, because we realized the personal is political, what is cultural is political. You know, it was really.
And admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming, or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing. Some writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no love be later to win, for the times they are a-changing. From senators Congressman, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't lock up the hall, for he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls, for the times they are a-changing. The mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand, for the times they are a-changing. It is drawn, the curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last, for the times they are a-changing.
Oh, we're getting a call. I'm not sure. Do we? Who takes? Oh, the call. Okay.
It's probably a someone no, calling us about fundraising. So this is terrific.
So now I'll make a general statement. I mean, the United States, the collectivist tradition here, isn't as strong as the collectivist tradition in Latin America or in Europe. Mm-hmm. And by that I mean the idea of unions. Student societies, student groups, the National Union of Students in Britain was very strong and was a great supporter of the anti-apartheid movement. And here, things are so much more atomized. It's a much more advanced, the politics of mass society is so advanced in this country. We're decentralized. We've lost a lot of what I would call our secondary our secondary relationships. By that I mean we have our primary relationships with people in our family and our neighborhood. Our third level relationships are with the national government. Our secondary relationships are with our business colleagues, our organizations at work. Mm-hmm. These have been deliberately attacked for the last 20 or 30 years. You know, we want to minimize the ability of unions, the ability of people to get together to protest. Look what's happening in Wisconsin, you know, the Governor mm-hmm. Walker there. Look what happened. Newt Gingrich led this so-called counter-revolution, but basically it was to disempower and to degrade those secondary relationships. I know I'm talking like a sociologist, so I don't mean to do that. But basically, okay. People go out to the market, student education here is expensive. People are very individualized. They go from place to place, shopping, trying to do some credits here. Maybe they transfer from a community college. I think what would happen if when their interests are attacked, and I'm beginning to see students protesting the high fees. I begin to see students, they were very much protested the fact that when they were asked to go to Saudi Arabia in the 1990s, there were huge protests all over the country because suddenly they were being asked to go because many mm-hmm. of them were using their association with the armed forces, the fact that they were in the reserves or something like that, helping pay for college tuition. When suddenly they were asked to go, there were huge demonstrations in Springfield and Chicopee and in Northampton.
I don't feel like those were particularly covered in the media. I'm not having...
Well, back in 1990-91, yeah, I remember they were they were fairly well covered.
May have been before I was in this area. I also have some thoughts. I think that in Britain, working class people have more of a sense of who they are as a group and actually mm-hmm. have mm-hmm. some... There's a bit of ribbing and contempt for those who are more educated or wealthy, and right. there's just more right. of a understanding of who you are, who your parents are, and what your interests are. Whereas in America, I don't know if it's TV or media or what it is, but everyone in America seems to self-identify as a consumer, a middle-class consumer, rather than having a very clear vision of where they come from, who they are, who their parents are, and what their prospects are. I don't know why it's different here, but that's something that I've observed. I'm also of British origin, like you, and my father is British, my mother also. But
and to follow from that, yes, Una, that's perceptive, because I remember coming from England in 1972, the conventional wisdom was, oh, you're going to a classless society, because it so identifies as a classless society. In fact, when you bring the issue of class up, some people get very hot under the collar.
Yes.
You know, Republicans love to say, whenever you talk about inequality, economic inequality, oh my gosh, we can't talk about class. That's class warfare, you know. But in fact, class warfare is so advanced.
How that term has been misappropriated.
It's so well disguised here. I mean, I love this wonderful phrase by Marx, that the greater the alienation, the greater the mystification that's needed to justify it. Mm-hmm. Or to obscure it. And because this is the most advanced society in terms of class differentiation and specialization, more than any other nation that's ever done that, the mystification here has to be so much more evolved, more subtle.
You know, it's so funny, this term class warfare. I couldn't believe it the first time. I think it was actually Jay Fleitman in his column in the Gazette that he talked about, and I think it was... the taxation of the wealthy was class warfare. And I was really surprised, because to me, class warfare has always meant the violence wreaked upon low-income people. You know, whether, you know, women on welfare who don't have enough to feed their kids, homeless families who are often thrown out of the office in the transitional assistance office when they're trying to get into shelter. I mean, to me, that's class warfare. So I was completely puzzled when I heard it used as against not even particularly radical people, but liberals. I was amazed.
If anyone's listening, you know, and they can look at their own lives and think to themselves, you know, when class warfare is a big term, but it's like there is class. It's a socioeconomic construct, a way of looking at our society. And sad to say, there are classes in this country. And why the evidence I have, what has surprised me, was when a few people decided to occupy. I can't even remember if it was in New York City, the very first Occupy. Was it in New York City? How quickly it spread and how it became such a national thing, like overnight. It's like this issue is sort of lurking subterraneously amongst us, in our psyches, in our lives, because the vast majority of people are having a reasonably hard time. Some are having a desperate time just simply making ends meet. Mm-hmm. It's not like the 1950s, where, interestingly, we had high taxation rates. We had a very high taxation rate for very wealthy people, and our growth rate and our productivity rate was just unbelievable. And as productivity increased in the 50s and 60s, so did our remuneration. I've seen economists talk about this. You look at the graph, it kind of matches. And people made a decent living. People could buy houses in the 50s and into the 60s. And then starting in the late 70s, thing began to change. There's been this big divergence between while profits and productivity has increased, our wages have not.
You know, we've digressed a little bit,
yes,
but it's been really interesting. You know, I love talking about this stuff, but I'd like to hear a little bit from you also about when you came to the United States and the anti-apartheid movement here in the United States, because I'd spoken to you about this recently, and you told me things I didn't know about organization and, in fact, a bill being passed by the Senate and the activism among senators.
What interested me was that, you know, movements often progress, and
okay, I'm getting a signal.
Before I answer the question, do we need to
answer the question?
Okay, so I think you know, when we talk about boycotting and protesting against sport teams was one level. Now, gradually, as the situation in South Africa continued, it began going to a better level, in the sense that when I came to Northampton, there was a group called the Southern Africa Working Group. I immediately joined it. It was run under the auspices of the American Friends Service Committee, and it incorporated all kinds of people. And we're trying to think of ways of how to really bring the issue home here in Northampton. Think globally, act locally. And we realized that the South Africans were making these cheap products in what were called the Bantustans, where blacks were forced to be in these hostels and could only leave maybe 2 weeks in a year to see their families, had virtually no income. It's like a slave labor system.
So these are labor
system.
Camps of some
right.
sort.
They I were see. Bantustans, because they were segregating people into areas. This mm-hmm. was going to be a black area. Mm-hmm. And they were making produce that a company called Railroad Salvage was selling at the Hampshire Mall. Mm. And Krugerrands were a good way of getting some
and
sort of ready cash.
Can you explain to the audience what Krugerrands are?
Krugerrands are these silver gold coins, excuse me, that were very popular for collectors. And uh-huh. you could go to the, what's it called, on the high street? It was called Sutter's, I think. There was a jewelry store. And they were selling Krugerrands. So we decided to first, you know, we publicized it that, you know, these were not, we wanted to boycott goods from South Africa. Mm-hmm. Not only that, we wanted area businesses, well, particularly colleges, to divest their investments in companies doing business in South Africa. And that became a very successful movement. And we went to Sutter's and we explained the situation. And we said, look, if you're going to keep selling it, we're going to start having a peaceful picket outside and leafleting, and we're going to bring it to everyone's attention. And they voluntarily withdrew it. And we went to Railroad Savage and we brought all the local TV stations and we handed out leaflets. We were very polite.
You had a boycott.
And then we were told we were going to advise people not to go to the store and buy your produce because you're selling stuff that's made with basically uh-huh. apartheid slave labor in South Africa. And generally speaking, people were kind of, they didn't sort of say, oh my gosh, this is, they listened to us. And gradually this movement built up and a bill was brought up. You know, when people like Senator Edward Kennedy went to the South African embassy and himself got arrested and was led away in handcuffs, it was just,
incredible.
It was incredible. And a man called Randall Robinson had started this organization, a Harvard grad called an African, American in this country, called Trans Africa. He came to this area, Northampton. He spoke. He told us the many things we could do. And he led the national campaign to override the veto because the Anti-Apartheid Act passed in the Senate and Ronald Reagan vetoed it. And to get it.
So this was a bill that passed in the Senate.
Vetoed by Ronald Reagan to say we stopped doing business buying South African produce, we couldn't sell them weapons, we would not import Krugerrands anymore. This was really something the South African government didn't want to hear.
Absolutely not. But this is, it's amazing to me.
And this is why things
looking at today's government, it's amazing to me to think that we had a Senate that supported a bill that was that radical. Yes. I think we're going to go now to a little more fundraising.
Thank you, Una, for interrupting what is a fascinating discussion. It's a valuable tool that Valley Free Radio, WXOJ LP, provides in that we are talking history. We're talking about the collective memory. We're talking about something that corporate media tries to destroy. The attention span of the average American, unfortunately, today is not even equal to a soundbite, because you can't. The speed with which you are asked to digest information and see images creates an image or a perception that there is no past, there is only now. Here at WXOJ and at the Bread and Roses Show, we're giving you a chance to remember your memory, and we're giving you a chance to support Valley Free Radio, independent media in the Pioneer Valley. Please give us a call at 413-585-1033. 413-585-1033. That is the phone number as I'm going in and out. Or you can go online to valleyfreeradio.org, valleyfreeradio.org, and press the donate button and make your contribution. It can be any size contribution, $5, $10, $20. We don't have a limit, but give us a call, please. Show us your support as we continue bringing you information that actually is under attack. There was this week a hearing, a congressional hearing, in which the congressional committee were concerned about the fringe groups that are putting out a different message than the established message that the corporate media and that the government wants people to know. And they were likening that message to a tactic, a military tactic. They're serious, folks, and we're serious as well, to provide you with information and with premiums. Give us a call at 413-585-1033, 413-585-1033. Give us your pledge, and we will give you a gift if you prefer. We will tell you then if you call. We have tickets to the film. We have chocolate. We have dance lessons, tango lessons for a $40 pledge. We have Latin dance lessons for a $40 pledge. We have books by Bill Newman and Don Ogden as gifts. And we have an amazing two pairs of tickets to the Taylor 2 interpretive dance performance tonight at the Academy of Music. For a $40 pledge, you can get a pair of tickets to Taylor 2 right from New York City at the Academy of Music. Pair of tickets for $40 pledge to Valley Free Radio.
Smile and wave.
There we are. And once again, the phone number is 585-1033. That's our call letters, WXOJ 103.3. We bring you programming like Democracy Now! No one else except WMUA. A couple of others bring you the progressive programming, Occupy the Airwaves, and go to our website, valleyfreeradio.org, press donate, or 413-585-1033. Now, back to Una and the Bread and Roses show.
So I'm here in the studio with Michael Holroyd, and we have been talking about his memories of activism in the 1960s and 1970s, both in Britain and in the United States. We had just been talking about how there was a pretty active anti-apartheid movement here in the Valley. And I think you just said that Senator Kennedy was arrested protesting outside the South African embassy. I always liked that guy. And so now I want to ask you about, I think that you had mentioned before that there was some organizing and that some of the relatives of major players in South Africa were attending school in the area, and that they helped with the effort here and did a lot of organizing. And if you could tell us a little bit about that, that would be fantastic.
Well, one of the tactics that the South African government did in dealing with protests, the ones who were the most militant, they obviously put in jail and in some cases outright killed. But many of the academics that were like a pain in their side, they simply, even though they were South African citizens, they would just give them a ticket or tell them, basically expel them from their country. And that's why in the universities of Europe, particularly in England and many in the United States, were full of exiles, both white and black, because, you know, some South Africans were white. They lived there for generations. And, you know, being kind of a multiracial society, they descended, you know, from British or Afrikaners and been there many years. So I remember them. They were often the most militant of all. And they were very instrumental in educating people, talking about people. I remember I went with one of them to speak to the NAACP in Springfield and tell them about what apartheid was really. And it was very interesting. It was very heartening. African-Americans here, I mean, there would be a lot of, like, rolling in the aisles. You know, brother, hallelujah, is that true? I can't believe it, you know? I went to a black church in Springfield. It was just great. And just to let, you know, you can protest. Sometimes protests, you know, you go on for years and years and you don't seem to make much progress. And then suddenly things can happen. Once the Anti-Apartheid Act became law in the United States.
I think you had told me that there was that Nelson Mandela's daughter.
Oh, that's right. Well, we had Francis Crowe, who is very much alive in this area and who is instrumental in bringing democracy now into this valley, among many, many other things, the Southern Africa Working Group realizes that Mackie Mandela, who was one of Mandela's daughters by his first marriage, was studying at UMass. And Bishop Tutu, who was Archbishop Tutu, a Nobel Prize winner, who was protesting apartheid in South Africa, his daughter was down in Hartford. And I can't remember the man's name. He was the South African head of the National Union of Mine Workers. His daughter was also studying in the area. And we had this huge anti-apartheid demonstration with Richie Neal helped. He was the mayor before he became a congressman. He was the mayor of Springfield. And we had this huge march from an African-American area of Springfield. And a lot of people joined in because, how often do you have a big demonstration with all these colorful banners, with all these sort of other sort of blacks who are not actually American? You know, they're from South Africa and other parts of Africa, and we marched down. We had a great rally, and it was very heartening to see. And you know, the fact that the Anti-Apartheid Act became law.
And what year was this?
This was in about 1985, 86, somewhere around there.
And what was the destination of the march?
Well, down at City Hall in Springfield, there was a big rally, a lot of speeches.
And how many people do you think were there?
Oh, I would say several thousand. It was very hard.
Great.
And it was going all over the country. And it became an issue. And I can't remember which colleges, but I know UMass made the decision to divest, but that wasn't the big one. I think it was like when Amherst College, when the students there began occupations, and at Smith College there was an occupation, telling the trustees they should divest.
I was at Wesleyan. We had a big divestment movement there, and a lot of the students participated in a sit-in and shut down the administrative building.
It's interesting to see, just to jump ahead, it's interesting to see similar tactics are being used now on this whole issue of climate control. There's demonstrations and asking, at Harvard the other day, down at Brown, telling the Board of Trustees they should think about not investing in fossil fuel companies. So it's something that... So what my point is that you can do these things for years and years, a generation or more, and then suddenly things can happen very, very quickly. And once the South African regime saw that their business interests were affected, and some of the big mine owners, Anglo-American Corporation and big business players in South Africa began telling the government apartheid is not good for business. For a long time we got away with it from 1948, but no longer. 40 years or more, you know? Mandela's released. 4 years later, there's a black majority government. And apartheid is officially, at any rate, no longer the law of the land. And it could just change in a matter of years like that.
Did you imagine it was possible
five years
beforehand?
And I remember going to the party at UMass in 1994. It was like, how often do we protest and we don't really see a lot of change? And we may protest for half a generation, or even less or more. I don't know, but it'll happen about fossil fuels as well. There'll suddenly be a chink in the armor, and things can change very quickly. There's a change happening. There's a sea change happening in this country right now about black-white relationships. It really is happening, because black people, unarmed people, not just black people, Hispanic, white, but often black people have been shot for years. And now I'm hearing reports no one ever really kept any figures about it. And now it's come to the light. Just a conjunction of events. People have cell phones. They have social media. You know, the old story about how, business as usual won't work anymore. So...
I think with that, we're going to hear the third track.
Yes.
I think I need a little technical help here in the studio to get that going. Oh, but you know what? While we're figuring that out, we'll hear from our great fundraising guy again. And I have to say that I think the station is fantastic. I'm tuning into it more and more. There's great local shows like Out and About, where this young woman interviews people all over the valley about issues of sustainability. There's Fork to Table. There's a wonderful news show where they play a little bit of the news from Havana. And there's also an indigenous news program I've heard. So every time I tune in here, I'm hearing more good stuff, and I'm going to write my own check as soon as I'm finished with the show.
And thank you, Una, very much.
Thank you, Una.
And part of the reason you hear all of this great informative programming is that Valley Free Radio is a Pacifica affiliate. Many of our programs come from either the Pacifica Archives or shows that are currently on, I believe, Indigenous Voices, Native American, Teokasin Ghost Source Show, I think was the one that Una was talking about. But we also have Democracy Now! That will be following this broadcast, and we have Occupy the Airwaves and the Enviro Show, and of course the Bread and Roses Show, which we are extremely grateful for all your support. We want to thank Alan Wheeler, who called in during the show to donate, and earlier Nick, who called in with an additional $25 pledge. Thank you so much for your support at from the Bread and Roses Show and for the Bread and Roses Show. All of us here appreciate your support and your listening, as we all do down at Valley Free Radio. The phone number, once again, is 413-585-1033. 413-585-1033, or you can go to our website at valleyfreeradio.org, valleyfreeradio.org, and right as soon as you bring the website up, you'll see a big donate button where you can press the donate button, click on the donate button, and that's it. Just put in your information, and we will give you our thanks. Also, we have many, we will be continuing for the rest of the weekend. And I guess that's it. 413-585-1033. Again, thank you for your support. Back to Una and the Bread and Roses Show.
Hi, and now we're going to play Michael's third chosen track, and that's Imagine by John Lennon.
Say